Hi, I'm Nathan Weinbender, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Dan Webster, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that loves both Martin Scorsese and Marvel movies. Whatever happened to nuance? As we inch closer and closer to Oscar season, when we'll no doubt be talking more about Mr. Scorsese, the well of quality movies grows ever deeper. And this week we'll be discussing two films that might be in the conversation come Academy Awards time. The first is The Lighthouse, the newest curiosity from indie distributor A24, a waterlogged, wind-whipped chamber piece turned psychological freakout. And following that, Judy Garland will take the spotlight, as she tended to do, in the appropriately named Judy, starring Renee Zellweger in a performance that's practically begging for Oscar gold. But before we go over the rainbow, let's make a seaside stopover. Robert Eggers made a name for himself with his visionary 2016 debut, The Witch, a grim, satirical, impeccably designed horror film that played out with the blunt power of a folktale. His follow-up feature is The Lighthouse, and it's as strange and unforgiving as that earlier film. It's also, I think, some kind of weird masterpiece. It's set in the late 1800s on a remote New England island, where the only inhabitants are the so-called Wickies, who tend to the lighthouse and live in uncomfortably close quarters, in a shack that's constantly buffeted by ocean water. The man who stays out there is Thomas, played by Willem Dafoe, an old salt who speaks in fluent buccaneer and who no doubt smells as grimy as he looks. His newest assistant is Ephraim, played by Robert Pattinson, who's left on the island for a few weeks and is immediately thrown into the most taxing and backbreaking jobs on the island. But soon, Ephraim's suspicions about his roommate and the worker who came before him arise, and it becomes imminently clear that there's no replacement coming to alleviate him of his duties. And once that realization lands, his and Thomas's daily routine descends into drunkenness, paranoia, sexual repression, and violence. What immediately separates The Lighthouse from any other movie in theaters right now is its visual style. Shot on 35mm film in beautiful black and white, and with a boxy aspect ratio that hasn't been used since the silent era, its angular shadows and the exaggerated geometry of its sets recall the German Expressionist movement of the 1920s and 30s. It's a look that not only reflects the isolation and claustrophobia of the story, but exacerbates it. And how to adequately describe the tone of The Lighthouse? Well, that's a challenge, but I was thinking all the way through of Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, who so often wrote about men being driven mad by solitude and who intertwined the supernatural with the psychological. But the movie is also uproariously funny in places, disarmingly so, and Dafoe and Pattinson deliver perhaps the best performances either of them have ever given, descending into mania as they guzzle down bottles of turpentine. The Lighthouse may not be your cup of tea, but you've certainly never seen anything quite like it.
Well, I'll agree with that last statement, certainly. And The Lighthouse was definitely not my cup of tea. It threw me back into when I started seeing movies when I got out of the Army in the late 1969, in the early 70s, and I would go to a little theater in La Jolla, California. And I remember seeing Woman in the Dunes. And
oh, great
the
movie.
Japanese, yeah. great movie. But I remember being thrown into complete confusion because I could not figure out what the movie was about. I finally just had to say, well, okay, I don't really understand the specifics of this movie, but I'm going to go with it and I'm going to watch it again. And I did watch it again. And I did derive a lot more meaning out of it the second time. So maybe I need to see The Lighthouse the second time.
It's interesting you bring up Woman in the Dunes. I didn't think about it, but there's a lot in common with this movie, The Lighthouse, because it's about two people who are essentially trapped in a place. And that place is sort of an allegorical conceit in a way.
Right.
And it's sort of up to you to take away whatever meaning the director is trying to impart. That's a really interesting comparison.
The starkness of the external landscape, at least in The Lighthouse, contrasts markedly with the sort of claustrophobic interior that they're dealing with, which kind of mirrors their external-internal struggles
their mental state, and so forth.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you'd mentioned Edgar Allan Poe and H.P. Lovecraft, but the two people I thought about the most were Lars von Trier, specifically his film Antichrist, and David Lynch with Eraserhead. And all those movies just absolutely, the very first time I saw them, just absolutely knocked me upside the head. And I thought, what am I seeing? And I really don't know what to make of The Lighthouse. Yeah, I agree with you that there are disarmingly funny moments in it in which I had to laugh out loud. Mary Pat and I both laughed out loud. I don't think anybody else in the theater did,
yeah,
but we did.
I had the exact same experience, right, where it was a mostly silent theater and I was cackling at this, just the absurdity of this movie, the beautiful absurdity
and
of
that,
it.
And that's exactly the right word, because as this movie went on, it starts in a certain place and it just becomes more and more absurd. And Eggers just gives us so many scenes in which we don't know really what to make of it. I mean, what do we make of Willem Dafoe hiding out in where the prism is and he's naked? I'll have to see The Lighthouse again to give it a fair view, but I can't remember the last time I was so confused and distraught walking out of a theater.
Well, okay, so I guess I'm a little confused by your confusion in terms of the plot, in terms of what the director was trying to convey, in terms of the relationships between the people. Okay, okay.
Yeah. Just all saying. Of the above.
Just, okay, just asking, you know. I was fascinated by this film. I mean, I thought it was beautifully shot. There were so many small moments where he sort of focuses really intently. The director focuses really intently on something. And I'm thinking of the scene where Robert Pattinson, like, gets his little mermaid muse, figure.
Yeah, right.
That he dug out of his mattress.
Right, exactly. Right. And you don't know what's going on. And then you're like, oh, well, what's this about? Oh, I see.
Right.
But probably the most entertaining feature of this was the audience. I mean, we saw it in a packed theater at the Magic Lantern, and I am virtually certain that many people did not know what they were getting or what they were getting themselves into. Maybe I'm incorrect, but I just suspect, because you see these two now A-list indie stars and Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame and, you know, everything in this movie, and you have really no idea, unless you've read about it in advance, what it's going to be. And it was this sort of monologue that turns into a dialogue that turns into this course of dealing, and of course—
And a soliloquy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And for me, it's captured by the stark landscape, and especially for someone such as myself who is frightened of birds, it did have this recurring bird theme.
A one-eyed throughout. Seagull that is menacing Robert Pattinson and it has basically
throughout.
Staked out his territory on this island and don't cross this bird.
Right. And so you don't, I think the confusion piece is you don't really know where it's going to go. And it goes someplace that's simultaneously expected and unexpected, given what we see. I mean, basically what happens to these two guys is they sign on, or at least Robert Pattinson's character signs on for this short-term gig, 4 weeks, at this lighthouse. And, of course, we know the weather gets stormier and stormier, so the 4 weeks gradually slips into something much longer and much more intense, just as Robert Pattinson's mindset starts to change, too. I don't know. I was fascinated by this film. I can't really recommend that people rush out to see it, but
except for this, except for two sterling acting performances, both Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. Pattinson, I mean, this guy has turned in some of the best performances that I've seen in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And who would have ever thought, both he and Kristen Stewart coming out of, it's like the Beverly Hills 90210 syndrome, in which people are in this stupid show and they're bad actors. And then they get out and you see that there is much more talent there to be.
Yeah, all
with.
Those great performances Jason Priestley delivered. Post 90210.
Right.
Well,
I don't know if that's
a
great comparison.
We won't speak ill of Luke Perry at this point.
Right, may he rest. But I want to talk about expectations in The Lighthouse, because I think I liked this a lot more. In fact, I think than you two. And I think this might be my favorite movie of the year so far. I really loved
something.
It. And I want to talk about expectations because I've obviously, you know, was familiar with Robert Eggers, having seen The Witch and enjoyed that, and knowing the kind of film that A24 puts out and having seen the trailer and even read a couple of reviews. And even then, this movie was not what I was expecting it to be. It's been advertised as kind of a psychological horror film, and it certainly has those elements. But it like I said, it is disarmingly comic and almost slapstick in a couple of places. And it ends up kind of being the showcase for these two performances. And I thought both Dafoe and Pattinson were just at the top of their game, delivering this crazy dialogue with, you know, this feverish intensity. And I just I liked it a lot. And, what a wonderful surprise it is and a wonderful experience to go into a movie and you think you know exactly where it's going to go. And by the end, it's completely confounded you and you walk out thinking, I have to see that again. But I'm less concerned with what this movie is about or what message it's trying to convey than just the experience of, you know, being led down the garden path by this film, because it's surprising over and over again.
It did remind me a little bit in terms of what they were trying to do of Midsommar, in the sense that you go in there expecting mm-hmm. one thing and you go completely off the rails.
But this,
it just
I think,
didn't
this
work
is,
for me as well. As
I
it
think
did
this
for
is
you.
Better than Midsommar in every respect. Another movie it reminded me of was Ingmar Bergman's Persona. So think of all the different movies that we've called out here: Eraserhead,
right.
Persona, Woman in the Dunes, and that's The Lighthouse. And I think you should absolutely rush out and see it. But now, it's the time on the show where we take our break. Before we go, let me remind you that you can hear older episodes of Movies 101, as well as the weekly reviews that Dan and I write, at SpokanePublicRadio.org. When we come back, we'll be discussing Judy. Kind of a tonal shift there, don't you think? You're listening to Spokane Public Radio.
On the alert!
Hello, it's me.
A message to you.
Wait, what? Are you talking to me?
And talking to you.
I need a dollar, dollar, dollar. That's what I need. Hey, hey.
Oh, it's Spokane Public Radio.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
Please call me.
That's right. I need to call them.
Tell me something good.
I'm going to call Spokane Public Radio and give them some money.
I want to thank you.
You are the best thing ever happened to me.
Yeah, cool.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Nathan Weinbender. During the first half of the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I talked about The Lighthouse. Let's turn our attention now to a beloved pop culture icon. You can't talk about 20th century cinema without eventually getting around to Judy Garland. She was, in her own words, born out of a trunk, and her childhood in vaudeville translated to a movie career that first paired her with Mickey Rooney and eventually led her to starring roles in such musical classics as Meet Me in St. Louis, A Star is Born, and a little film called The Wizard of Oz. But most anyone who's studied Hollywood history knows that her life was not an easy one. So it's actually surprising that it took this long to get a musical biopic about Judy Garland, considering the emotional highs and lows of her story. Judy stars Renee Zellweger as the silver screen icon in the final months of her life, when she experienced a brief comeback through a successful string of dates at the London nightclub The Talk of the Town. The film is most concerned with Judy's relationships, particularly those with her de facto British manager, played by Jesse Buckley, who she works into a frenzy before every performance, and with rock promoter Mickey Deans, played here by Finn Wittrock, who married Garland shortly before she died. Zellweger's performance is obviously the selling point here. We know from Chicago that she has great pipes, and she actually takes on some of Garland's greatest hits herself, the trolley song Get Happy, and of course, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. She's impressive, but unlike earlier musical biopics, the highlights of Judy aren't the actual performances. They're the small personal moments, particularly a scene in which Judy invites a couple of fans to dinner and ends up staying up all night in their apartment. Of course, the great irony of Judy Garland's life was that the drugs that made her so productive in her early career would later render her unemployable, and yet she was forced to take any paying gig she could when she really should have been drying out. Judy is a solid, if workmanlike, elegy to a career that ended too soon. Think about this. Renee Zellweger is actually older than Judy Garland ever was. and hopefully it steers more people toward the real thing.
I liked Judy, and I liked it unexpectedly in some ways.
Me too.
There are some faults and some flaws with the movie, but I was really impressed with Renee Zellweger. I mean, she's gotten sort of mixed reviews, although everyone says, again, as you indicated, Nathan, that it's, you know, an Oscar-worthy performance or an Oscar-nominated performance.
If you want to get an Oscar, this is how you do it.
Well, apparently so, yes. We've seen it before. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason why I wanted to focus a little bit on Renee Zellweger, because you said, oh, this is a bizarre segue from what we discussed in the first half, The Lighthouse. But in some respects, this is about Judy Garland and Renee Zellweger, because her career has been very intriguing. If you look back, way back to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then, of course—
And she was in that with Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, yeah. And then people know her, of course, because of Bridget Jones. Bridget Jones 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever. And then, as you mentioned, she was in Chicago and an award-winning performance in that film.
And won an Oscar for Cold Mountain a couple
years later.
Right,
that's what I was going to say. So then we have Cold Mountain. And then she sort of disappears for a while, and we don't see her. Jerry Maguire, whatever, you know, but we don't see her. And she consciously took a break, I think, from the whole Hollywood celebrity thing.
Yeah, but didn't that have something to do with cosmetic surgery? That was in the tabloids.
I think this.
And we believe everything we read in the tabloids.
I know. I think this her break predated that, but you could be right. I think that – so this opportunity for her to come back and do this and showcase some of the things that she's good at, I thought was an excellent choice for her, because I don't know if the Bridget Jones thing was a good choice for her. Now, having said all this, I mean, I thought they kind of painted over some of her unusual behavior, whether it was drug-fueled or alcohol-fueled or whatever, especially her course of dealing with her kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in there, but I think they could have actually, highlighted that a little bit more, because this ends up being a feel-good picture, more or less.
And we've talked about the whole trend of musical biopics, taking the PG-13 route for R-rated lives. I mean, life is R-rated, but these lives in particular. And I do agree with you that I think Judy probably would have been a lot more potent if it had been more honest. But that's not really the kind of movie this is, and I guess you kind of have to – either you'll accept that or
right,
you won't.
And that's why I ended up liking it, because I finally said, okay, this is going to be a slice of her life
and
during this brief period of her life.
Yeah.
And it doesn't completely ignore – I mean, this is the final gear of her life, and we know where she's going to go. I mean, the woman died in the bathroom, accidental overdose at the age of 47, and this is – the lead up to that. So, I mean, it doesn't ignore things, but you're absolutely right, Mary Pat. It does soft pedal some of the particular attitudes toward her children. I mean, there were stories about her, you know, threatening one of her kids with a knife and threatening to jump out a window in front of another one, you know. But in this movie, did we really need to see that?
It almost would have been kind of sadistic.
It's not the Joan Crawford.
Exactly.
Right.
It's not Mommy
I think
Dearest,
that would have been exploitative,
yeah,
and maybe even gratuitous.
I mean, she already had been dealt a bad hand. Do we need a movie that just, you know, underlines what we already knew?
Right. Okay.
My question is,
what did you think about the flashback aspect of this with the young Judy Garland? Because that's gotten some, critique from, I think, some notable film reviewers.
Well, Hollywood historians have said that, because in the flashbacks we see her dealing with Louis B. Mayer, who sort of, you know, pushed her into the spotlight when she was young, and have said that that wasn't really an accurate representation of him and how he treated her. But we certainly get the sense that, you know, she's being starved, she's being fed these pills. I mean, those are well-known facts. And the flashback, I always have a problem with these kinds of flashbacks anyway, because they feel less like emotional scenes than explanatory scenes. Mm-hmm. But I thought the young actress that played Kid
Darcy
Judy,
Shaw, is that
I thought she was good, and they even got a young actor that looks pretty uncannily like young Mickey Rooney. And actually, I was more interested in her relationship with Mickey Rooney than the movie was, mm-hmm. because there is this kind of conversation they have at this empty diner where, you know, she says, are we dating? And he kind of pushes back against that. But the movie kind of glosses over that a little
bit. I think the biggest surprise for me was how good Renee Zellweger was, particularly since she sings all the songs. And, you know, all right, Judy Garland had a voice, particularly when she was 16 singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, that very few film actresses ever had. She was a great singer. And Renee Zellweger is a good singer, but she's not a great singer. But she's also trying to capture the Judy Garland who's 47 and nearing the end of her career. And so I think that it holds up. And the one scene where she does sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, she cracks in the middle of that because and for effect. And so I think they handle all that really well. Now, is this Marion Cotillard in La Vie en Rose when she played Edith Piaf? No.
Although Marion Cotillard didn't sing her own song.
No, she did not.
You know, there is arguably a higher level of difficulty here. But again, this is not my favorite kind of acting where we're talking about technique and impersonation. Like, you know, going back to Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody, or even not a musical performance, but Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour.
Right.
I just find these kinds of performances to be showy in a way that takes me out of the movie rather than pulls me in. And I certainly felt there were moments in Judy where Zellweger was kind of she was playing the tics of Judy Garland, because after I saw this, I went on YouTube and watched just a mm-hmm. bunch of live videos, and she gets a couple of the things just right, but it does feel a little tick laden,
which is why
I liked the sequences that aren't her performing. It's her relating to other people. I thought those were much more potent.
Well, like when she meets with the two guys. I mean, we have no idea.
That.
She goes with these two fans and hangs
out
with them.
And I think that's
the best scene of the movie.
I agree.
Yeah. And so that I thought was really poignant and touching.
And she makes omelets with them in their apartment.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure that, you know, she was a gay icon.
Yeah.
And so I think that sort of speaks to that aspect. And it also speaks to the loneliness and isolation that she was feeling.
How do you get around this? Do we not do these kinds of movies? I mean, because this particular kind of movie calls
for imitate?
That.
Do you
performance?
Extrapolate?
Well,
I don't know.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't
exactly.
kind of thing. And I think that it's less about the performance and more about the script. I think the script here is a little bit obvious and heavy-handed
in places.
Joaquin Phoenix
is Johnny Cash.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and that works. I mean, that's a pretty heavy-handed script too. But I mean, I think that in terms of just the you know, getting to the fireworks factory of Judy Garland, I mean, I think that she does that. And I think that the scenes where she is on stage and singing, they do have a lot of energy. I mean, I think it's a performance that it very well could win the Oscar. I don't know. This is the kind of acting the Academy eats up
traditionally
with a knife and fork.
Eats up, yeah.
Okay. Well, that was Judy, and this has been Movies 101, where earlier in the show, Dan Webster, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Lighthouse. As always, I'd like to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And I'd also like to thank our loyal listeners for tuning in every week to hear us, even when Dan's opinions are wrong. We'll be back next week, same day, same station, to pick apart the latest movies. And until then, consider these words from the legendary Judy Garland. I've always taken The Wizard of Oz very seriously. I believe in the idea of the rainbow, and I've spent my entire life trying to get over it. You're listening to Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.